From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the world's greatest living adventurers, sailor Tristan Jones. He's probably sailed more miles than anyone alive through circumstances that should have killed him a long time ago. Also today, we meet Kaif Fassett. He's brought a painter's eye and vision to the previously staid craft of knitting. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of three Mendelssohn string symphonies, and book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Jennifer Casolo, the American church worker arrested last month in El Salvador, is on her way to Miami at this hour after her release earlier today from prison. Tom Gibbs says Casolo was freed for lack of evidence.
Jennifer Jean Casolo is due to arrive in Miami shortly. She was released from the women's prison outside San Salvador earlier today after a judge decided there was insufficient evidence for her detention. She was arrested last month after police found a large cache of explosives and ammunition buried in her backyard. She maintained her innocence and denied any knowledge of how the weapons got there. President Alfredo Cristiani, however, said he was morally certain of her guilt and was therefore deporting her. He said investigations into the case would continue. He denied giving in to U.S. pressure to release her. Decision, however, is bound to cause problems for Cristiani from his own right-wing constituency. They were calling for an example to be made in the case. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
The opposition and the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia has resolved its last remaining dispute by agreeing today that the president of Czechoslovakia should be elected by parliament before the end of January. There is reportedly no agreement on who should become president, only that the person chosen would be Czech and not affiliated to any political party. The Energy Secretary has decided to release classified records of plutonium production at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State. Carol Levinson reports.
For the first time, the public will be able to learn about plutonium production and radiation leaks at the U.S. government's nuclear weapons production facility in eastern Washington. Energy Secretary James Watkins is declassifying scores of documents from the mid-40s through the 50s. They're being made public primarily for use by a panel studying how much radiation was released from Hanford and how it affected the health of nearby residents. Critics of Hanford applaud Watkins' decision, but say it doesn't go far enough. They want all the Hanford documents released, including more recent ones detailing radiation leaks from the Hanford N reactor, which is no longer operating. A Hanford spokesman says it will probably be spring before the first documents are declassified. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson.
Democratic House members today continued their attack on President Bush's decision to send high-level officials to confer with Chinese leaders. Representatives say the White House has refused to allow one of those officials to come to Capitol Hill to defend the action. Connecticut Democrat Sam Jensen said the president is willing to send Lawrence Eagleburger 6,000 miles to apologize to the Chinese, but won't send him 2 miles to explain the action to Congress. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 9 points today to close at 2761.09. Advances led declines 8-7. This is NPR News. A former crewman of the USS Iowa today called the Navy's investigation into the Iowa disaster a cover-up. NPR's Kevin Niedermeyer has this report.
In testimony before the House Armed Services Committee, Petty Officer Kendall Truitt said it's ridiculous that the Navy claims sailor Clayton Hartwick probably intentionally caused the gun turret explosion. Truitt, a one-time friend of Hartwick's, says the Navy is probably afraid of losing its World War II vintage battleships and was trying to make an accident look like sabotage. He believes poorly stored gunpowder or a faulty loading mechanism likely caused the blast that killed 47 sailors, including Hartwick. Truitt is a beneficiary of a life insurance policy taken out by Hartwick, which made him a suspect early in the investigation. In other testimony today, a chief Navy investigator said he made a mistake in waiting until 3 weeks after the explosion to get involved. By that time, a lot of evidence had been lost. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer.
A group of leading House Democrats has asked White House counsel C. Boyden Gray to investigate whether President Bush is being given economic advice from people too closely tied with foreign interests. A letter released today by House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt expresses concern about the chief Japan expert for the President's Council of Economic Advisers, Gary Sachsenhaus, who is an advisor to Japanese financial groups, including a research institute financed by Japan's Ministry of International Trade and Industry. A Gallup poll released today shows fewer Americans are now keeping up on the latest historic political changes in Eastern Europe than followed the opening of the Berlin Wall earlier. The poll conducted for the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press said only 28% of the people are closely following news of the breakdown of communist rule in Eastern Europe. It's a sharp drop from the 50% who said they closely followed the Berlin Wall story. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Tristan Jones has sailed more than 450,000 miles around the world and has crossed the Atlantic Ocean 22 times in tiny boats. He was iced in for a year in the Arctic and was sunk three times in the North Sea. Though Jones lost a leg to gangrene in 1982, 2 years later he embarked on his fourth voyage sailing around the world. Tristan Jones was born at sea aboard his father's tramp steamer in 1925. He spent his childhood in Wales, but dropped out of school at the age of 13 and went to work as a deck boy on a cargo ketch. He served in the British Royal Navy during World War II, but was caught in a mine explosion so severe the doctors told him he would never walk again. Jones' most recent series of voyages is called Outward Leg and is dedicated to showing that the disabled can do anything. He has adapted a boat and trains disabled children to sail with him. He's written 11 books about his journeys, including Ice, The Incredible Voyage, and Somewhere East of Suez. I asked Tristan Jones if becoming a sailor was inevitable for him.
Very much in the European mode of like father, like son. You know, your father's a piano maker, you become a piano maker. And my forebears... as far back as I know, anyway, going way back into the 1400s, had all been seamen.
And is the sea beckon you? I mean, is that the kind of relationship
you... No, I hate
it. You hate it?
Can't stay. I can't swim a stroke. Hate salt. I'm allergic to salt water.
And yet you've spent your life practically
on
the
sea. Well, I say I hate the sea, but there are a lot of things I love about it. The changing scene, it's never the same for 2 hours running. And the fact that a boat is a vehicle to get to places that it would be impossible to go to in any other by any other means.
So
that still applies for a lot of the world's surface, you know that.
Well, is it then the boat that you love more than the sea?
Oh, yeah, sure. You're always protecting the boat from the sea all the time. You're always wary of the sea, always looking. If I wasn't wary of the sea, I wouldn't be sitting here right now, believe me.
You mentioned the fact that you don't swim well at all since your accident
Well, it was blown up.
Part of your spinal column, I guess, was blown up. And you were told that you weren't going to walk again. Did you at any point believe what the doctors told
you? Yes, I did for about one suicidal half hour. And in fact, an Irish nurse came up to me in the military hospital in Aden, and she said, well, you're looking glum for a Welshman. And I said, well, I've just been told I can't walk again. And I'd been studying this rail with the idea, well, there's a 30-foot drop down there. I can do it in 1 second flat.
Just throw yourself over the rail.
And she said to me, what you need is a good drink.
And right? She was right?
She wasn't right, because I never drank after that. And now this is going to surprise a lot of my readers. I've been dead bone dry since that day. But what she did, she brought me down to earth. She told me that she recognized how I was feeling, right? And that it was within my own capacity to bring myself back.
Well, how did you do that? I mean, you're told you can't walk. How do you begin to walk?
Well, I told myself that if they said that I couldn't walk, I wouldn't believe them. And that somehow or other I would be able to get on my feet and move myself. It's been a struggle. It's not easy. It's still, well, it's even worse now. I've only got one leg. And I'm losing the use of my right arm as well here. I've got about 2 years left on that. So that means I won't be able to use a cane. But then I know there's electric wheelchairs, and I don't know how they work in the jungle or on board a boat, but it'll be fun finding out.
I want for our audience to know that I guess it was back in the early 80s you had your leg amputated because of gangrene.
Right. Now, what happened was that I had a shrapnel in my left foot during the Battle of the Sharnhorst. I'm a museum piece. And this shrapnel wasn't supposed to move, you see. And all the medical gurus said, oh, don't worry about it, it won't move, it'll last your lifetime. Well, it didn't. And in 1982, it started to move. There were magnesium bits started to move up the veins, aiming for the heart, which naturally it would do.
Sure.
Being German, sorry about that. But I had my leg off in St. Vincent's Hospital, New York, and when I came to, I thought, well, that's it. I'd been in so much pain and agony that I was just delighted to be out of pain, at least temporarily. The biggest shock of all was when I was put out of my bed and started circulating around other people who'd been in accident. And the doom and despondency that I met there, I'd never come across people so that had lost hope, so deeply despondent. They were young Americans.
And right? you could taste it, feel it.
Oh, sure.
Breathe it.
I got them running a wheelchair race.
You got in trouble for that,
out,
didn't
right.
you?
But before I got... Well, as I was being thrown out, or not thrown out, shown to the door, because the bill was getting heavy, that was the main reason. They said, what are you going to do now, Tristan? I said, well, I'm going to sail around the bloody world again. And they said, you're crazy. I said, well, I'll see you when I get back.
Did you have to deal with something called phantom pain? I mean, feel as if
your
leg...
Yeah, that's a very strange thing, and a lot of older people get it. I understand that young people don't experience it as much as older people. It seems that pain is not in your limbs or in your nether parts at all. It's all in your brain. And therefore, when the limb's missing, the pain still exists. Now, older people have been frightened of mentioning this because other people, able people, might think that they're a bit crazy. But it does exist. If I'm sitting in a boat's cockpit and a big dollop of cold seawater comes aboard, my missing leg freezes in that cold seawater. My foot freezes, okay? If I'm in hot weather, my left foot, or even though it's buried in some pauper's graveyard in New York City, it just sweats itself off. And when I take my sock off my leg, it smells the same as it does on my right foot. Now, explain that one to me.
Well, I was going to say, what does that tell you about pain? Because I would think that you wrote, really, that you can't get rid of pain, but you can control it.
You can control it. You don't embrace it. You look upon it as a challenge. You realize that without pain, you would not be human. And like everything else human, it's a gift from God, whatever the supreme deity, and that you must accept it for that. It's your body signaling you that there's something wrong. It's your body being kind to you. And you're not kidding yourself on this.
Are you in pain now?
No, I'm in discomfort, but I always am while I'm wearing my leg. Mm. When I get back on board my boat, I can take it off. There's nobody else around, I can take it off. I'm still embarrassed. I'm still vain enough. You know, the uglier we are, the vainer we are. This is one of the delights of the human.
I don't know if I agree with that, but it's an interesting statement.
Well, you wouldn't know, right? But... Then I can take my leg off and get my stump sunburned, and then I don't feel too bad about it at all.
My guest is sailor Tristan Jones, and he's also a writer. He's written many books about his life. The Incredible Voyage, Ice, Outward Leg, many, many other kinds of books. And he has sailed around the world 3.5 times, and he's crossed the Atlantic 20 times, 9 times by himself. And he does this unsponsored and unsupported by corporations. There's no corporation logo on his mainsail as he sails around the world. And he's particularly interested in working with disabled youngsters and showing them and showing the world that the disabled can do just about anything. You spent most of your early time sailing by yourself, and you say that you were up to your gunnels with some of these children, but I would think going from solo sailing to a boat full of a couple of kids has got to be a big change. But I know that you started off sailing with a dog called Nelson, a three-legged, one-eyed dog. Tell us about Nelson.
Yeah, well, he was, he was a Labrador, and in those days, this is back in the late 50s, there wasn't so much navigational electronic stuff around, and you couldn't, I mean, no, I couldn't afford a radar set. And with going up to the Arctic, the best radar you can have is a Labrador, because if there's the noise of the sea on the shore, you know where it points straight at it. They know where it is. I can't tell you. Nobody can.
But
Nelson could. It's a 360-degree sound being bounced off the particles of fog. But a dog could, you see.
Yeah.
And he'd been born on board a sailing boat, and I wouldn't take a dog that had not been born on board a boat. It would be cruel. But a water dog, it's okay. A dog that's at home in the water, that loves water, that can swim, okay. They can jump over the side, do his business, come back aboard, and then he's all right.
When you were stranded in ice in the Arctic, which you were for about a year or so, was Nelson with you?
Yeah, all the time. He was my last meal in extremis. I don't think he ever realized that, but he was good company.
Yeah. Did you talk to him when you sailed?
Yeah. You've got to realize that the natural condition of humanity is to talk to itself. Did you know that? If you, I guess, in the West, in urban society, you see somebody sitting in a corner talking to themselves, you think, a bit loopy. But there's nothing wrong with talking to yourself when you're alone.
And you did that. Did you talk
out
loud?
Some of my very best conversations have been with myself, believe me. Especially when I've been angry with myself.
And do you use different voices for different parts of yourself?
I've invented quite a few words.
I'm curious, though, when you were stuck in ice, and I don't want to underestimate the danger that you were in, and it was howling cold outside, I suppose. I think I read 64 degrees below zero, and you were truly stuck in ice. What did you do for a year, and how do you keep yourself from going crazy?
You invent yourself a routine. A lot of it doesn't have to be invented, because in any boat at any time, if you live in a boat, you've got to certain routine to carry out. You're feeding yourself. You make work, right? You keep yourself occupied, and you dwell more on survival than on anything else. Don't dwell on the reasons for it, because a fish or a plant or a dolphin or a whale doesn't even bother why he should survive. He just knows that he should. And that's the way we have to be. We must survive.
I wonder, though, when you are stranded and alone, whether you do lose track of time. I mean, whether I suppose that routine, in a way, gives you a sense of time. The time is going by.
No, you lose sense because in the Arctic, in the winter, it's all night, so there's you've no sun to go by, and time gets a lot slower.
Huh.
In some respects, and faster in others, because one day, the day, quote-unquote, melds into the next one. And you lose track of your sleeping hours, and you gain the ability to be able to fall asleep at will. You just say, right, I'm going to sleep now, and sit down. Whatever time it is on your watch, on your clock, you'll fall asleep.
Could you hear the ice begin to break up?
Oh, terrible. It's a very noisy place. It's noisier than, I don't know about Philadelphia, it's certainly noisier than New York City.
Well, there's nothing noisier than New York City.
It's like being in a war. It's cracking and explosions all the time. We imagine it because most scenes that are shot in the polar areas are taken during a fairly calm period, or in the Antarctic, where you're not actually on sea ice. But in the Arctic, when that starts breaking up, it's like being in a major earthquake.
Did the ice crush your boat?
Yeah, it squeezed the boat up. But the boat, fortunately, had no keel. She was specially chosen for the job. Mm. And put her up at an angle of about 45 degrees, sitting down on a stern. And the an iceberg, which I'd been moored behind, capsized. As the weight of the snow on the top mounted and mounted, made ice, so it capsized. And the whole world collapsed.
And what happened then?
Well, I went a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Sure, I was crazy. I was by your standards, I was crazy.
Screaming crazy?
By my standards,
or?
I wasn't. Because when you got nothing to lose anymore except your life, things become a lot clearer.
My guest is explorer and sailor Tristan Jones. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Tristan Jones, and he has probably sailed more miles than any other person alive today, and at last counting, it's 450,000 miles. And he has crossed the Atlantic 20 times, 9 times by himself. He has sailed around the world 3.5 times, and his latest interest is in sailing with disabled youngsters to show them, and I suppose show the world, that things like this can be done. Reading about your life and hearing you talk about it, I said to myself, I don't understand why you're still alive. And I guess the things that happened to you, it seems as if fate has been very kind to you, or maybe there's something about the way you live or the way that you are able to survive that
it's
means that you're alive.
I've, there's a purpose somewhere, you know, and all these things are very difficult to see when you're close to them.
So having this kind of purpose, you feel, has, in a way that probably none of us understand, has kept you alive, is why you're here?
No, I'm alive because I'm a bastard. All right, my time is not yet up.
Is it that simple? You're alive
Well, I mean, if I croak it tomorrow and something happens the day after tomorrow, that I could maybe have affected it a little bit better, right, then I shall feel that it's my fault. I've done something wrong.
Well, you see what I think.
They'd be calling me Revolving Jones. I'd be turning in my grave for the next 30 years.
I guess my question behind my question is how you deal with things like fear. And I guess I think of myself
fear
being alone.
Fear is the nether side of intelligence. If we know what we're dealing with, we're not afraid.
Uh-huh. I guess I imagine myself alone in the middle of a storm, and seeing waves around me are enormous.
What's fear going to do for you?
Well, I don't know what it's going to do for me, but I can imagine feeling
it. I'll tell you what it'll do for you. It will prevent you thinking clearly about what you should be doing.
No question.
Right? So instead of sitting there trembling and getting on your knees and praying, the best thing to do is to figure out if what you should have done has been done. And once that's been figured out and all those things have been done, then you can say, okay, I'm in the hands of God. I'm in the hands of fate, whatever you believe in. Then you are at peace with yourself. I've never been at peace with myself except in extremis, in a storm. And I'm no masochist, believe me. I don't enjoy it. But I know that. You reach utter peace. If the nearest that a human being can come to nirvana in this life is when he's in extremis, beyond the point of danger. He's not accepting death. But when you are at the point where there's nothing else you can do, and whether you do it or not is irrelevant to the result, At that point, you reach nirvana. You have even go outside yourself.
And almost watch yourself.
You can watch yourself, yes. Sure you can.
I guess some people almost call that an almost death experience. I mean, to come out of oneself.
I don't think it's a death experience. I think because I've talked to holy men in Thailand and in Burma and places like that, and they tell me that this is a regular occurrence that they get through spiritual, through meditation, etc. But you do get it in extremis, sure.
There is a story I do want you to tell us, because I think it's quite astounding, about when you lost your eye. And I believe
I didn't lose it.
Well, you didn't lose it, but it was hanging by a thread.
I got mashed by a boom. I was up in the south of Iceland in the North Atlantic on this old catch of Crespo, and this gaff boom, that you know these gaff boats have two booms, and I let it down, it clattered down, it swiped me on the head, and my eye came out. I had a great
literally
big gash.
Yeah.
And it was down on my cheekbone. Yeah. And I was in such a shock, I staggered down below. I was in sea boots and I tripped and I fell over and I grabbed my eye as I went over and I recovered my balance. And I looked in this looking glass, I had a little looking glass by the companionway, and I shoved it back in the socket. There was all these things that looked a bit ghastly. And I got a sailmaker's needle. I was a lot younger in those days and a lot less thoughtful than I am now. I don't know whether I could do it now, but I sewed up the thing with some sail. You can see this car
barely
across here.
Yeah. Sewed it shut?
Just sewed it shut.
Keep the eyeball in?
And I couldn't see anything at all, and I shoved a handkerchief on it and put a bit of rope round and headed up for Reykjavik. I went into the port there and cleared in, went to the staggered. I somehow made my way to the port captain's office, and he, good God, he said, what's happened to you? I said, I think I'm blind in one eye. He said, I'll take you to the hospital. We got up there, they took this bit of rope off my head and the handkerchief came off, and I thought my eye's going to come out with it. And no, I could see perfectly. And the doctor looked at it and he said, you know, he said, you've made a better bloody job of that than I could.
And your eye's okay?
Yeah, I think it must have been the whiskey I was knocking back, because I used to carry it for medicine in those days. I was never a heavy drinker, but if I had something wrong with it, a drop of whiskey would make me feel better.
What's your favorite time at sea?
Dawn. Sure, because the night is always a little bit scary at night. Yeah, unreasonable scary. It's a throwback to our primitive beginnings, you know. And it doesn't matter how logical your thoughts are and how scientific you might be. There's some primitive part of us which we must recognize. And it's quite friendly, but it can also be pretty stupid and be afraid of the dark.
And dawn then is the kind of hope, I guess, that
happens?
Well,
it's beautiful. It's at sea, it's always, even if it's a gray, overcast day, dawn is still beautiful. It's still a miracle.
My guest has been explorer Tristan Jones. His books include Ice, The Incredible Voyage, and Outward Leg. He now sails with disabled youngsters in Asia and delivers crutches to other disabled people along the way. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross will speak with actor Ed Begley Jr. For years, he played Dr. Victor Ehrlich on TV's St. Elsewhere. He's currently co-starring with Meryl Streep and Roseanne Barr in She-Devil. I hope he can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. While he was just in his early teens, Felix Mendelssohn wrote a dozen string symphonies. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of three of the symphonies performed by the English String Orchestra. Kay Fassett was happily pursuing a career as a painter till the day he visited a Scottish woolen mill. The colors and textures he saw there convinced him to put down his brush and pick up a pair of knitting needles. Kay Fassett joins us to talk about the art of knitting. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Labyrinth of Exile, Ernst Powell's biography of Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An American woman accused of storing weapons for rebels in her garden in San Salvador has been deported and is now on her way back to the United States. Earlier today, President Cristiani of El Salvador said that there was not enough evidence to continue holding Jennifer Casolo. She was released into the custody of the U.S. Ambassador William Walker, who drove her to the airport in a black Cadillac escorted by jeeps and put her on a flight for Miami. During the meeting today of the Soviet Union's leading legislative body, the Congress of the People's Deputies, the Soviet Prime Minister outlined the country's five-year economic plan. As NPR's Ann Garrels reports, it disappointed reformers.
The Soviet Prime Minister's plan was a modest version of proposals by other Soviet economists, including his own deputy. Ryzhkov called for members of the East Bloc trading group, known as Comecon, to move to world prices as a step towards integration with Western economies. But he delayed domestic price reform for at least another 2 years. And he indicated the state would continue to play a central role in economic planning. Radical economist Gavriil Popov responded, "It's impossible to move bit by bit like this toward a market economy," comparing the Soviet economy to a car where the carburetor works and the starter doesn't. Deputies in the hall grumbled at Popov's remarks, a reminder that reformers are still a minority in the Soviet legislature. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
In Bulgaria, the Communist Party today followed many of its counterparts in Eastern Europe with a proposal that its leading role in society be abolished. At the same time, the party has expelled the country's disgraced former leader, his son, and a close associate. Jane Howard of the BBC reports from Sofia.
The three members of Zhivkov's circle who've been expelled were probably the most hated figures of the old regime. The former president himself, who held power for more than 30 years, is accused of serious corruption. Details of the allegations are only now beginning to emerge. He was noted for his extravagant lifestyle. He had 30 residences, for example. His son, Vladimir, is known for his drinking and womanizing. He's rumored to have gambled away millions of dollars of state money on the international gaming tables. Mr. Mukhobalev, also expelled from the party, was Zhivkov's number two. The Central Committee's decisions underlined the new leadership's determination to keep one step ahead of the opposition.
Jane Howard of the BBC. There are reports that the last major difference in Czechoslovakia between the opposition and communist over the election of a new leader has been resolved, and the new president should be chosen by parliament before the end of January. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 9 points to close at 2,761.09 on volume of 184 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The 19th century German composer Felix Mendelssohn was a child prodigy. In his adolescence, he wrote a series of string symphonies which remained unpublished until the early 1970s. A new set of CDs of these works has just been released. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review.
Three of Mendelssohn's five symphonies, the Scottish, the Italian, and the Reformation, are among the most popular orchestral works in the classical concert repertoire. Not so many people know that between the ages of 12 and 14, Mendelssohn wrote 12 symphonies for strings alone. He completed them 3 years before he wrote his famous overture to Midsummer Night's Dream, and a decade before any of his mature symphonic works. He was surely one of the most precocious of all child prodigies. When he was 8 years old, he could play from memory piano versions of all the Beethoven symphonies. He also played violin and organ, had a talent for languages and drawing, and from his earliest childhood was given a broad liberal arts education. 12-year-old Felix spent 2 weeks with Goethe just before he started his series of string symphonies. These 12 remarkable pieces were recently issued in loving performances by William Boughton and the English String Orchestra on 3 Nimbus compact discs. And though they get more ambitious and interesting and less derivative of Bach, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven as they go along, even the earliest ones have the Mendelssohn stamp. There isn't a single movement that doesn't hold your attention. Here's the beginning of the slow movement of the second. Mendelssohn himself apparently lost interest in these string symphonies and never published them. One of them, the ninth, found its way to the public in 1962. George Balanchine, who knew more about music than most musicians, used the ninth string symphony in his marvelous ballet based on Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. In addition to Mendelssohn's familiar incidental music to this play, Balanchine fleshed out his ballet with other Mendelssohn scores. The slow movement of the Ninth Symphony had a special place. It was not part of the plot. The second act of the ballet is essentially a series of divertissements to celebrate the multiple weddings of all the lovers. The high point is a grand pas de deux, one of the most exquisite and moving Balanchine ever choreographed. Imagine a sublime ballerina like Allegra Kent or Suzanne Farrell, bending and turning and balancing to this breathtakingly beautiful music. I first heard the Ninth Symphony in the 1966 film of Balanchine's ballet. The New York City Ballet Orchestra played it beautifully under Robert Irving. But I've never heard a more eloquent recording than this one by William Boughton. I think the most startling thing about all these youthful symphonies is the grave melancholy of their slow movements. They seem far from anything a teenager could simply pick up through imitation. I don't think even Mozart's early slow movements have such heartfelt power. When you get tired of repertoire as usual, these unfamiliar treasures are waiting to be mined.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed three new recordings of Mendelssohn's string symphonies on the Nimbus label. This is Fresh Air. More than 20 years ago, Kafe Fassett exchanged his paints and brushes for a pair of knitting needles. Using the simplest of knitting techniques, he has designed clothing that combines a spectacular array of colors. It's not uncommon for him to use 50 or 60 colors in one garment. Fassett turned to knitting after he moved to London in the 60s. He grew up in Big Sur, California, and was trained as a painter. Now he thinks of knitting as painting with yarn. He wrote his first knitting book of original designs and patterns in 1985. His newest book, his fourth, is called A Family Album. A few years after moving to England, Fassett visited a knitting mill in Scotland. At the back of the mill, he came upon barrels and barrels of colored yarn. This discovery led to the creation of his first sweater.
What was fascinating was to take lumps of yarn and begin to arrange them until they began to have a spark. And you were already halfway to something exciting by just arranging colors. What I do is technically very, very easy. It's just that I use a lot of colors.
Was it something even about the tactile nature of yarn that drew you to it? I mean, when you see a big barrel full of colors like that, you do want to put your hands in, at least
absolutely.
Up to the elbow.
Absolutely. It's pure sensuality. I mean, you know, that's what I was saying to this audience the other day when I was talking, you know, I mean, you look at paints and they're paints, you know. I mean, they're not something you want to rub your hands in. But, I mean, you see a ball of mohair or silk or wool sitting on a shelf and it says, come and get me, stroke me. You know, I mean, it's so exciting. And when you're actually knitting with them, they're flowing through your fingers, you know, and they're lumping themselves on top of each other in these little chains of... I mean, it's the most miraculous thing, knitting. I can't understand... Still, to this day, I've been doing it for 22 years, and I can't understand who came up with the concept of it, because the idea of these loops intertwine that can make this, they can make the whole world of pattern and color with these simple little loops. It's just so exciting.
You went to London in the 60s, in 1964,
yes.
And you've lived
right.
there ever since.
Yeah.
Did you find it an environment that you could work in as well? I mean, that it was a creative environment for the kind of work that you
were
doing.
Yeah, I liked the limitations, and I liked the sense of humor. And, you know, life is hard there. You know, we don't have the creature comforts in Europe. And I liked that. I liked knowing exactly where I was, and life was affordable. I mean, it wasn't luxurious by any means. And I suppose I could take a chance. I could go out and buy very inexpensive yarn and knit mad things. I did thousands of experiments. And maybe if the material hadn't been so cheap, and also if anyone had taken me seriously, because the other thing is that the English didn't take me at all seriously. They just thought I was a total madman from this weird foreign country, you know, so that I was able to just get on with my thing, and I didn't need to make much money to survive, and I didn't.
And they left you alone.
And they left me alone. And then when the product was really developed, when I really got to a point where I knew what I was saying, then they took me seriously. And when the first book came out, you know, Glorious Knitting, it was called there, Glorious Knits here, suddenly they said, right, you're our hero. And, you know, 40,000 copies of the book sold out in 2 weeks, which we all just fell down, because I thought I'd be talking to elite little groups of people that had kind of found out about me by hook and by crook, the few talks I'd given and things, and that would be my audience. And suddenly, it was like this universal thing. Every bookstore sold out, every yarn shop sold out. It was so phenomenal that none of us could understand it. You know, and we printed seven times, I think, you know, in a year or something. I mean, it was just phenomenal.
When they left you alone, was it also lonely, or was it important that you be able to work out some of this stuff without the intrusion of the public or the press or anybody else?
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, I was so obsessed. I was so turned on. I mean, when I first, the first sweater I knitted, I was so excited. I used to get up in the morning, and before I'd get dressed, I'd be knitting for 3 hours. I would just sit in a chair, stark naked, knitting away. I mean, at 6 a.m. You know, it was like, this was thrill time. I mean, I'd found something, you know, that was so mysterious, these little loops and these colors growing. I couldn't put it down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I took that first sweater to Vogue, and they took it seriously enough to print it in their magazine and to say, do us another garment. So people were listening to me in that way. That didn't bring in money, but it brought, there was enough attention around that I knew I was onto something. And I didn't care whether it ever made money, really. I was just doing it because...
Sounds like you couldn't not.
I couldn't not. That's it. I mean, I just simply couldn't put it down. I kept thinking, I must be serious now and grown up and go back to my painting and be a painter. But I just put my painting away. And painting never satisfied me again. You mean, I went back to my painting for a brief spell and had a very successful show. But the knitting always dragged me back. And when I was able to do a book and make money at it, boy, I just put the paints away totally, you know.
The actual making of your sweaters, you don't require fancy triple cables and all this kind of stuff. It's basically the stockinette.
That's right, stockinette. I've kept mine totally simple. In the family album, there's a lot of things that are quite simple and straightforward. There's a lot of two-color row knitting. There's a lot that's lots and lots of color.
Yeah.
And then there's some that are cables and fancy stitches, too, for those people that like that.
Did you ever toy with a knitting machine and that's so different than, as you say, running the yarn through your hands.
You got it in one. Because, you see, to me, I mean, it's the therapy of having the beautiful contact with these yarns. It's not about, you know, and standing there shoving this bloody machine back and forth. And on the 16th, it all falls off anyway. I mean, oh, my God, it just drives me insane. I nearly killed my instructor. I had one lesson, and I thought, this is not for me, you know.
You like squares. I mean, I think that's apparent in looking through the book, that there's something about the square that's very attractive
to
you.
Well, squares or circles. I love geometrics that one can build on and play on and carry it in your mind. I mean, there's something about a geometric pattern that you can memorize very quickly and then start to play with variations on it. Something that's like flowers or more, you know, three-dimensional kind of shapes and so forth, you have to sort of put those on graph paper and you follow a graph. And then you can't do it in a car and a plane so easily. You know, you can kind of manage if you have to. But the great thing about a geometric is that you can just begin, you know, you sort of memorize it in the first few rows, and then you can improvise and play and just do variations on shapes and so forth. And the design below tells you what's happening above, and you just can go on. And I love that aspect of being able to just, you know, run out and sit in a field with a little bag full of balls of yarn, or, in you know, if you're lonely, go sit in the town square and watch everything go by and sit and knit, you know.
I do need to ask you a technical question, only because I'm a real novice knitter. I've done a couple of rather bland-looking sweaters in my day. Mm. But how you don't get everything all wrapped up and tangled around each other. I mean, I'm looking at this sweater that you're wearing that probably has 25, 30 colors work.
And it has about 10 to 15 colors a row.
Yes.
Every row.
And how at the end of the row you don't have everything in a...
Well, thanks for asking that, because I forget to say it sometimes. There's three things you got to remember, and that is you work with manageable lengths of yarn when you're working with lots of color across a row so that you never have balls attached, and you certainly don't waste time making butterfly whatnots, you know, because they would get tangled and you couldn't pull it out of the tangle.
Right.
And a manageable length of yarn is anything from a few inches to... say a yard or a yard and a half.
So you're always tying on.
Well, not tying on. What you do is when you come sort of within 2 inches of the end of your yarn, you grab another piece, hopefully a slightly different tone or texture, and then you leave a 2-inch tail of that, knit one stitch, and then you knit the two tails in. And so it's all nice and tidy. It's all finished when you're finished. And you knit all your ends in as you move along. Just weave them into the back of the knitting. And it's very, very simple. Once you've learned that, that's the keys to the kingdom, you know?
I was wondering what artists you've been inspired by. And looking through your book, I mean, there's certainly Matisse.
Oh, absolutely, Matisse, number one.
Because they're the patterns.
Yeah, you've been looking. You've been really looking. Yeah, M. Bonnard and Emile Nolde. Anybody who's fabulously interested in color. But also much subtler, like old Italian frescoes. When you want to go for a very soft, old, faded palette, which I often do. I'm sitting here in blazing
you
red
are.
And swimming pool green and blue and all these things. But, you know, that's because I'm, you know, making my little public appearance on radio here, you know. But I do love very subtle colors, you know, colors that you can wear when you've got a toothache and it doesn't, you don't know what's going to bother you. You know, you can creep by, and yet if people take a really close look, they can see there's a lot of subtlety and a lot of tone there, particularly dark, burnished, bronzy colors. I adore.
When you're just traveling around, is color then what you notice? I mean,
absolutely.
That's,
yeah.
And perhaps it's what many of us don't notice. But.
Yeah. I mean, like the most unpromising place, like a crowd of people when you're really mad because, you know, this place is so crowded and you can't get to your destination on time. There's bound to be the most amazing combinations of colors passing each other, or just the colors of people's hair, you know, standing in the tube, you know, crowded tubes in London, and looking across over the subway, say here, and just seeing all the shades of people's hair. You know, I mean, I can get off on that and think, what amazing carpet this would make, you know, like sort of dog pelts or something, or just looking at the shapes of people's noses. I don't know. You know, there is amazing variation in our lives, and certainly every city throws up the most amazing old neglected buildings. I mean, I go for the ones, the slums, you know, where things have been left to nature, and old peeling surfaces and so forth are just fabulous, the kind of colors that occur quite accidentally.
Well, thank you, Kay Fassett, for talking with us. I've enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it, too.
Kay Fassett's newest knitting book is called Family Album. It's published by Clarkson Potter. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. In El Salvador, Jennifer Casolo, the American church worker accused of hiding weapons for the rebels in that country, will be released and deported tomorrow. They say there's not enough evidence. Our week-long series on guns in America continues, and we'll talk with NPR's Deborah Amos in Leipzig, East Germany, and NPR's Sylvia Pajoli in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Also, Chicago gets set to approve the world's tallest building. Actually, it's the world's tallest structure, even taller than the CN Tower in Canada. We'll talk with the architect who designed it.
Thanks, Noah. These stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new biography of Theodor Herzl, the Czech-born founder of the Zionist movement. The book, called The Labyrinth of Exile, is by Ernst Powell, who's also written about another turn-of-the-century Czech citizen. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
In Ernst Powell's superb biography of Franz Kafka, The Nightmare of Reason, he told us that the godfather of alienation was in real life over 6 feet tall, good-looking, with lots of friends in Prague Café Society and the insurance business. Nor was Kafka's father such a rotten fellow. Kafka's problem was a Jewish identity crisis, and to understand that crisis, we had to understand Prague and the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the last decades of the 19th century. Powell, a novelist and critic born in Berlin and raised in Yugoslavia before moving to the United States, undertook to explain this cultural context with remarkable grace, somber intelligence, and surprising wit. In his equally compelling biography of Theodor Herzl, Powell tells us that the godfather of Zionism was a terrific journalist, a mediocre playwright, a manic depressive, and a self-hating Jew. Worshipped by his mother, doted on by his father, devoid of introspection, ignorant of Marx and Freud, amazingly untouched by the winds of change that revolutionized philosophy, literature, and the stage in his own generation, Herzl loved Wagner and was afraid of women. We can't understand him without understanding not only Prague, where he was born, and Vienna, where he grew up, but Paris, too, where as a reporter he discovered anti-Semitism, the Dreyfus case, and anarchism, the voluptuous pleasure of a great idea and of martyrdom. He was, says Powell, so emotionally constipated, so morbidly repressed and inhibited in the sexual sphere, that it's tempting to see his consuming devotion to the Zionist cause as a form of sublimated sexuality. If, an ironic Powell goes on, one accepts not only the broad Freudian premise of culture as the product of sublimation, but conceives of just about every human activity as sexually motivated, the conclusion becomes self-evident, as well as totally irrelevant, in that it fails to explain why Herzl, of all people, was moved to found Zionism, whereas another man's repressed desires make him practice psychoanalysis. This is Powell being wicked. He has already described the apocalyptic temper of Vienna as a product of the anguish of its Jews. He has gone into the extraordinary diaries, Herzl's romance with history. He's made himself at home in the onslaught of idea splinters and the eruption of the unconscious that created this Vatic visionary. He's sorted out the original plan, a mass conversion to Christianity, from subsequent revisions that might have settled the diaspora anywhere from Argentina to Uganda. He's followed Herzl from Vienna to Paris to London to Constantinople in search of favor from popes, emperors, sultans, czars, and Rothschilds. He's taken us to three Jewish national assemblies where Herzl the playwright hit upon an alchemy of mass manipulation that successfully transmuted fantasy into power. Powell disdains simple-mindedness. If Herzl, at age 44, essentially killed himself for the cause, Powell reminds us that heroism is seldom devoid of self-destructive impulses. There is, he says, a subtle but by no means insignificant difference between suicide and self-immolation. And if Herzl failed to notice that some Arabs happened to be there already in Palestine, well, so did everybody else.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Labyrinth of Exile by Ernst Powell. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Terry Gross will be back tomorrow. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor Ed Begley Jr. He played Dr. Ehrlich on St. Elsewhere. Now he plays Roseanne Barr's husband and Meryl Streep's lover in the new movie, She-Devil. That's next time on Fresh Air.